75 and 9, the awesome Wendy's in their prime. The bowl is quick, the batsman fine. Remember? Do you remember? Nope, I can't remember. That was too long ago. Yeah. Holding Marshall, Garner, Lloyd, and Mighty Bib. Mighty Bib. They were going for the hat trick, the greatest team that lived. That lived. They swagger and they stagger out. They shake their heads, they cry. How on earth did we lose to a team that played Yash Ball at 5?
Hey, listener. Welcome to episode 3 of Talking World Cup. And this time we've got a couple of the finest cricket writers going around. Folks, we're proud to call our own. First up, senior journalist and someone who's been covering cricket for the best part of the last 3 decades, I think. Sharda Ugra, welcome on Talking World Cup.
Hi, thanks so much for being here. What a flattering introduction. It's all downhill from here, I promise.
It's all true as well. And also on the show today is Fidel Fernando, our Sri Lanka correspondent. And again, like I said last time, one of our funniest writers. Fidel, hello again. No pressure.
Hey, Srinath. Hey, I'll try to crack a few more jokes this time.
Yeah, it was fun last time when we did the World Cup preview. This time around, we're a little light on the analysis stuff, but we'll talk to you and find out how it is to travel with the World Cup. First up, Sharda, where are you right now and what game are you about to cover?
I'm at Bristol and tomorrow is the Asian Super Clash of Pakistan and Sri Lanka. And I'm very excited. And because the ground is small and I think window panes are going to be broken with sixes and so on.
Sri Lanka will be hoping for a few more sixes than they have managed so far. Fidel, what about you?
I'm in Taunton, just got in a couple of hours ago. There's an Afghanistan-New Zealand match happening a couple of days from now, so that's what I'm here for.
All right. Taunton should bring yet more sixes than any other ground, it is hoped, because it's one of the smallest grounds. Of course, for neither of you, this is your first World Cup. You've been doing this stuff for a while, Sharda, you specifically, so we'll roll back the years in a little while. I know you've written many times over that your grandchildren aren't going to hear, they're not going to care about how many World Cups you've covered, nor your CV. So we'll keep it a little light on that. It's 2019, there's a 10-team World Cup in town. What's the word from England? Is there a general awareness that the World Cup is on, or is it just a subcontinental expats tournament? What's the story?
At the moment, it's sort of, you do see signs of it, in Cardiff and now in Bristol. But the signs are, what I have come to conclude after these many World Cups is that the way World Cups are seen in India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh is not the way it's seen in the rest of the world. You know, so we are just completely, World Cups just take over our cities, our lives, advertising hoardings, television airspace. But here it's just sort of a semi-event that happens. And people turn up when they have to. So I remember in Cardiff, we kept saying there's no crowd, there's no crowd, there's no crowd. But people turned up. You know, you go to a ground at about, the match starts at 10:30. You go to a ground at about 9:45 and people start trickling in. And they're trickling in at a steady pace. It's not like they're not there. But it's not like they'll be around trying to get tickets. You know, there's like crowds chasing after. There's nothing of that. You know, that kind of interpretation of what World Cups are like. You have to kind of lower your expectations in the sense of that degree of excitement, which is why the World Cup, when it comes to South Asia, just becomes another different, becomes like this large unending rock concert, which lasts for more than 6 weeks, you know. Here it's a little bit quieter and it just pops up now and then because there will be excitement when matches are on in neighborhoods. In Bristol, for example, it's like a little, it's like literally we're in a neighborhood and there are buildings looking into this. And I've never been to this ground, so I'm very happy to be here. And the buildings looking into it, and it's really tiny. You know, it's all grounds.
I think at Hampshire, it's inside a hotel complex, if I'm not wrong.
In Hampshire, it is a bit far away from the city as such. I've been once, and there is a hotel attached to it because no one else. You know, I don't think players would want to spend the time going up and down from Southampton City into the stadium because it's a good distance away. So that's the kind of event it is, but it's not that there's not excitement around it. If you come to the game, say 5 minutes before the toss, you will see a lot of people.
Fidel, mm-hmm. This is, I think, if I'm not wrong, your second World Cup. How different is it to go around these smaller towns of England compared to the bigger stadia of Australia and New Zealand last time? And if I'm not wrong, correct me if it's your third or fourth World Cup.
No, it's just my second. And yeah, you're right. I mean, but in New Zealand, we also had these smaller, smaller grounds in smaller towns, you know, places like Napier, Queenstown. So a few of those places, even Christchurch is not really that big a that bigger place anymore. So New Zealand kind of had this feel of going to smaller towns and these like boutique venues being packed out. What I will say is that New Zealand had a bit more buzz around it, especially once the team started to win. And you know, that I remember watching that match against England where New Zealand won it, you know, in the space of like 25, 30 overs and absolutely smashed them. Just remember, you know, just being in, I think I was in Dunedin at the time, and just everybody in the restaurant and the bar I was watching it at was just completely buzzed and over the moon about what had happened. And if you walked out into the town, you'd end up having conversations about cricket. So New Zealand kind of got into the spirit of it quite a lot last time. Australia, not so much. I remember one time there was this a great match unfolding at Eden Park, but I was in Sydney at the time. I was trying to find a bar with a TV that was showing it, and finally found a sports bar. There were about, you know, maybe 50 screens in the bar. Only one was showing the cricket in a corner. So Australia didn't quite have that vibe. But yeah, I mean, I agree with Shah that it's nothing like in South Asia when these world events come. It's a completely different thing. It takes over our lives. Everyone's talking about it. The cities are decked out for it. People, all the closet South Africa fans and Australia fans come out in the open and are proudly wearing their kits and all that kind of stuff. So it's a different thing. I think generally, I think what you said earlier about the South Asians being more into it is true. There are lots of people you talk to that aren't even really aware that a World Cup is going on. But maybe it'll pick up. I don't know. Well, maybe if England win a few games and the newspapers start giving it a bit more coverage. Now football season's pretty much fully over,
yeah.
So maybe it'll pick up.
I think we were seeing last week, just before the Champions League final, Europa League final, England's first game was, I think, the morning of the Champions League final, the day before, and all the back pages were having full pages on Liverpool and Man City and features related to that, and cricket was barely in a corner just before that. So you're right on football. I'd probably bet, based on what both of you have said, that India's got more ads related to the World Cup, even though it's happening in England, than England itself. In terms of how different is it to cover a World Cup in 2019 than when you first started out in 1996, if I'm not wrong. I know we bother you a lot for videos and stuff like that, for social media and all the other fancy things these days. But that aside, how much else is different?
I think if you do go through a World Cup in South Asia, I think you're ready for every other World Cup that ever happens. Any kind of big sports event covered in India, you're ready for it. Nothing else compares to that, and just in the sense of sheer madness. I remember in 96, I was a very junior reporter at the time, and I was sort of second reporting person for India versus Australia and Wankhede Stadium, which was just mental.
Did you travel outside India?
No, not for the 19. Yeah, I did go to Sri Lanka, actually, when they just had a very big bombing, the biggest at the time in Jan, on the 31st of Jan. In a couple of weeks, they played a match and the West Indies and Australia wouldn't go. So the Zimbabwean team had gone, and that was the game that we went to, I went to cover. So Colombo was very, very, you know, different. It was quiet. It was, but the fans turned up because they were just grateful that the Zimbabwe team had come and they could actually have their World Cup. And I think, I don't know if the readers know this, but they played a joint match in solidarity. We've written about this on cricket.
So India and Pakistan together.
India and Pakistan together played Sri Lanka just to show solidarity and say, it's fine, we'll come, we'll play. Yeah. You know, what's the big deal?
Yeah, Wasim and Sachin played on the same team for one day.
And they all wore white clothes, you know, which because it has happened to be a match. They played it in daytime. They played it with a red ball. And it was just a completely, if you think about it now, it just seems an impossible thing, you know. So they didn't have social media. They didn't have, we barely had computers. We had no, you know, nothing gizmo, nothing fancy, no corruption, which is now you see it is a mistake. No anti-corruption. Sort of, regimentation and no separation of press from reporters and all the rest of it. So it was a completely crazy level of sort of proximity to the entire action that was happening. And I'll tell you just the whole thing about a World Cup in India is that, or Pakistan or Sri Lanka, is that the India-Pakistan match, the semi-final in Chandigarh, it was, the press box in Chandigarh was so packed in Mohali. It first of all, for a 2:30 match, we were at the gate at 10:30 and we had to wait for 250 dogs that were the sniffer dogs to go through one gate to enter the stadium. So for the 250 sniffer dogs, and then all the reporters went in after that. And then it was so packed in that press box that if you sort of moved your elbow from one end of the long bench on which you were sitting, a coffee table at the other end of the bench would sort of fall off and break. You keep thinking, yeah, so nothing of that sort is going to happen here. You know, there's no such excitement that you want the cricket to be a little bit more exciting than you want it to be just revved up to another level in terms of the quality. And hopefully this will be like that. And maybe as Andrew's saying, that if you're not following England as such, you don't sense this whole thing around them, other than sort of Indian fans will turn up.
Bangladesh, now I'm thinking, as well, I think, to some
and extent. Bangladesh, yeah. I don't think I'll be to a Bangladesh. I'll get to a Bangladesh game this time. But I'm just trying to figure out, like, if, say, India had been playing now in Bristol, you would have Indian fans around, buzzing around the ground at least, you know, just causing, trying to break in and enter, trying to do all kinds of other match. You would have that.
You've met some utterly interesting folks. You've got a guy from Canada on video who's traveled to watch Sri Lanka, was it?
Yeah. He's a Sri Lankan who worked at the airport. I don't know if he was air traffic control. He worked at the airport in Edmonton, in Alberta. And he'd taken leave and he'd come here. I literally stalked him from the time I saw him. He said, I'm going to pick up my ticket. So I said, oh, please. I mean, let's have a chat. Let's see what's happening. And you had people. And the Afghans turn up also at various parts. These three or four guys had driven from Stoke-on-Trent in Manchester, which is miles away. You know, it would have taken them at least 6 hours to drive, even if the roads are very efficient and traffic-free.
This is up to Cardiff?
Up to Cardiff, yeah. From Stoke-on-Trent, which is near Manchester. And they come, the Afghans are great because they actually bring a very old-fashioned kind of fandom to cricket. They come dressed in their national colors. No one ever comes just wearing shirt, trousers and whatever. They just come dressed like, we are Afghans, and they carry flags and they do the whole thing. So it's quite lovely to see this new, you know, and you hear press conferences in Pashto, and I get very excited by all those kind of things. So the difference has been largely in the kind of professionalization of the cup, that it's got shinier and more efficient. And the cricket, of course, has got faster.
That Sri Lanka fan that came from Alberta, if you're a fan that is traveling continents to come and see this Sri Lanka team play, you are a hardcore fan. Like that man is, or that who their person, whoever it was, they're like serious about Sri Lanka cricket. Because I had so many friends who had booked tickets in Colombo and Kandy to come and watch the World Cup, and they just saw the form of the team, and they were like, maybe we'll save it for 2023 or whatever. So if you're a traveling Sri Lanka fan, I think big respect to the work you're put in to watch this particular team.
Yeah, hats off from all of us at ESPN Cricket Info. I think he even mentioned that just before this World Cup, all the games he had watched, Sri Lanka had won. And he was so disappointed that they got thrashed by New Zealand in the first game. There was him and there's some people from Dhaka who said that the Oval felt like Mirpur when they played New Zealand recently. So all of that, the subcontinental fans taking such long journeys, continues to be a feature of the World Cup. They're there no matter where it's held. Sharda, just a quick word on the journalistic side of things. We won't dwell on this for too long. In terms of how it was in the 90s and the 2000s, from covering and doing deadlines to midnight or whenever for the magazine or the paper that you worked for, to now you're filing pieces in the middle of the game. Your article is up on the website before the game's even over. So that's quite a sea change.
Massive, massive. You know, so the whole thing is, you know, I went from working for a newspaper, for a tabloid afternoon paper, to a national newspaper daily, then to a magazine, that I thought I would have to go into some, you know, much more slower form of monthly writing or whatever. Now I've actually come into a website where you have to say, okay, file, 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 fast, fast. I'm not very fast, but I'm not the slowest. I'm proud to say we're not going to take names here. It's quite crazy. And because communication has become so easy, it's actually made your life tougher in that sense, you know. You had deadlines which newspapers used to tell you. So I worked for the Hindu from their Bombay office, and the desk would be waiting for your copy to land. So you were just writing match reports. So even the nature of what you're writing has changed. Nobody wants a match report anymore. That's done 5 minutes after the game is over, you know. So you're looking at other stories and other angles, and during the game you're looking to see what else can be written that is done. So it's almost like much more microscopically covered than it was in the past. You know, I don't think there's a twitch from a player that will go unnoticed on some form of social media or the other. It's exciting. I mean, it's for me, it's sitting at a press box and waiting for the match to start, for the first ball to be bowled. I still get excited, no matter who's playing. As long as it's competitive, I'll watch. And of course, people will be astonished to know that there were no media managers before.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Luckily, in 1996, they had a manager. And he says, sir, we want to speak to the captain. And there'll be just general kind of muttering about, okay, when, how. And you just mill around the captain standing on the ground with your recorders. And you have a chat with him. And that was the end of it. There was no sort of monitor, monitoring of what the player said. If a player wanted to give you a great quote, if he's angry, he'd just do it. As Fidel knows that Lasith Malinga gave some fantastic quotes in Sinhala on the first day, just after the, on the day, I think it was after the first match. Yeah. So, you know, he came before the match against Afghanistan. He just came and gave fantastic quotes. And you used to get a lot more of those fantastic quotes when there was no media managers around. I don't think there's any other way you can organize it, because it's become so much bigger as a spectacle and as a television event. But, you know, you miss the old, slightly amateurish cottage industry kind of World Cup that you've covered as a reporter.
That sort of nostalgia is fair, because it shouldn't become robotic at some point. And Malinga is one of the few exceptions, as Fidel would attest to. Fidel, the one interesting thing that a lot of us observe, and a lot of readers as well point out from every once in a while, is that you guys get to cover teams that you don't traditionally cover. For you, for example, you're not necessarily covering Sri Lanka at the World Cup. Sharda's not necessarily traveling with India, for example. How different is it, and how do you get set for something like that? It's a rare opportunity to watch other teams play live. Is that how you see it?
I get excited whenever I watch other teams play. It's one of my favorite things to do at a World Cup or at a world event. Thankfully, in Cricket Info, we have enough people who are people like, for example, if I don't cover a Sri Lanka match, we've got people like Sharda, who's covering a lot of Sri Lanka games, who are more than capable of filling that breach, and obviously have so much experience and so much skill that they bring to that. So that frees me up to cover other teams that I'm interested in following. So what I think is that the nuts and bolts of what you're doing is always going to be the same. You're always going to be, the nuts and bolts of storytelling don't change. Your technique that you bring as a writer don't change. What you need to do maybe a little bit more when you're covering unfamiliar teams is do a bit more research, work out what their recent history is. If a certain player is doing well in a match, you think you have to write a story on them. You've got to dig into their past and read a few features that other writers have done. That kind of thing. But that's also what keeps you fresh as a writer. You know, you learn new things about yourself. You develop your writing when you put yourself in unfamiliar and uncomfortable positions. For me, personally, as a writer, I feel like I've grown having to cover teams other than Sri Lanka. And covering Sri Lanka is always a joy. But, you know, occasionally you need to go and do something else and clear your head of that particular team and the bubble that they live in, so that you can experience something else. And when you come back to writing about Sri Lanka, you'll have had those experiences and you'll be a better writer for having, broadened your horizons a bit.
It's huge fun. I don't think of it as a particular difficulty, because it's literally like you're just diving into the deep end, and you can actually, I think you feel a little freer to make mistakes. And I love all underdog stories. So I'm all game for covering any kind of, this is not to say that Sri Lanka or Pakistan are underdogs.
Or Afghanistan.
Let me clarify immediately. No one is an underdog in this competition.
Yeah, if you're a listener and you're wondering what people traveling and writing about cricket for a living are complaining about, or what I'm asking about them about what's hard about their job, we'll get to the fun bits. So we'll start with Fidel in terms of, this is, of course, the second World Cup. And what's the one "I was there" moment that you felt, Fidel, in terms of, you know, I'm so lucky to watch this game live and write for a living? What's the one game that you can remember? It needn't necessarily be a World Cup, but it's better if it's a World Cup. When you felt truly lucky to be watching a game live, to see a narrative unfolded so far?
I mean, there have been lots of, probably my favorite moments have been in tests, but if we're just talking about World Cups, that spell that Wahab Riaz bowled to Shane Watson in Adelaide in the quarterfinal in 2015, that's something I'll never forget. Just not just because of the quality of that spell, but the Australian crowd's reaction to it. I mean, the Adelaide Stadium is absolutely vast. The stands just loom over the cricket, like you're right on top of play. It's a beautiful stadium, but also it's incredibly loud. There are so many people there. And I was in the stands for a huge portion of that spell, and I just saw people just being drawn into the cricket. I mean, normally in any stadium, no matter, you know, you watch an IPL game or an international match of any kind, there are people doing this and that, you know, eating, buying hot dogs or buying beer, or
someone's just standing in the aisle.
Not 100% of the fans are focused on what's happening, but I felt like everyone in my surroundings was 100% focused on what was going on in the middle. That's very rare, because it was such a magnetic spell of play. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that in one day cricket. That does happen in test matches, but in one day cricket, I've never seen that happen. And that was something I'll never forget. Also, I mean, I've watched, you know, Australia play in at home before, and the crowd is very, very partisan. If a ball goes up in the air of an Australian bat, pretty much the entire stadium is yelling at the fielder, trying to make him drop it. When that ball went up off Watson's bat after that long spell of him just being not able to handle Wahab's pace and the bounce, when the catch went up, it was dead quiet. And I thought I would never, ever see that. I've never seen that before in an Australian stadium. I possibly will never see it again. Just the deathly silence.
And he still dropped it. Rahat Ali, I think it was.
And he dropped it. And it felt like people around me were almost disappointed, because there's very few bowlers who deserved a wicket more than Wahab of Watson at that time. And that was, it was such a surreal experience, because Australian fans were kind of like, maybe it would have been better if he had caught it. You know, it's like it was one of those things that just transcended like nationality or team support. It was just like everyone was just enjoying the spectacle of the cricket. That I'll remember. Also, I'll also remember Eden Park, the next match that I covered, Eden Park, that South Africa and New Zealand final.
Oh.
Yeah, the Grant Elliott. And the noise that the crowd made. We were, I think it was me, Sambit, and Firdos sitting. We were actually outside in the stands, and just the noise of that stadium, the absolute euphoria, and everything that had led up to it, from like New Zealand being like a reviled team. New Zealand cricket was, you know, 3 years before that was absolutely reviled at home, and then to go from that to this just all conquering love. At that moment, to have watched that, you know, come to pass was quite incredible as well. So those two, I think, were unforgettable.
Fidel's pulled out a couple of belters from the 2015 World Cup. Shahda, you obviously have got a more vast canvas of memories to pick from over the years. What are your favorite moments? I hope you were at the 96 semi-final.
I was a very junior reporter, so I didn't get to go to the big games. But what I did cover, because no one, you know, only junior reporters get to go to the games, was West Indies versus Kenya in Pune. And it was the night after, exactly, it was the night
the afternoon after, of Tariq Iqbal.
Exactly. And it was the night after that Australia match, so you reached Pune in time and so on. And what was wonderful about that game, and the other match that was on the same day was South Africa versus Pakistan, so that was a pretty good game also, but no one was watching it. And all the Kenyan students of the city had come, and they were singing the national anthem. And I could hear it still. And this was, you know, we were sitting at this, like, the old Pune Stadium press box. This is not the Mercedes-Benz of stadiums that they have now. It's an old one, and Nehru Stadium, again, which is at the heart of the city, near the bus terminus. And it was just that whole thing of just magic, you know, that was happening. And I just remember it, and I kept thinking, I've got the story. So this is my real bad journalistic, bad or good or whatever, good, bad, journalistic instinct to say there is no way that they're going to bother about that other game. because of this match. And I had, you know, lead story at the Hindu across five massive columns. It was just, I mean, it was vanity, but it was just such excitement. And at that time, I'll tell you, literally we got down off the press box, we walked across the field, and we were standing outside the dressing room, and people were coming up and giving us quotes and talking and seeing this, that, and the other. And the other good one is a bit of cliche, but because I was sitting in such a good seat, we don't know why. At the moment, the press boxes in England are very badly positioned with respect to journalists, which is a bit sad. I was sitting literally on top of the in perfect line of the wicket at absolutely the perfect height to see Tendulkar hit an uppercut of Shoaib Akhtar at the Centurion in 2003. And India were chasing, I think, 270. And at that time, 270 was like impossible and whatever. And that it was like the shot that made the match, you know, and it was the shot that just finished the game.
Yeah.
At that one point. And my colleague was sitting next to me, another newspaper journalist sitting next to me, and he said, "What?" He said, "This is probably a better seat than even Nelson Mandela had." I said, "Yeah, probably." You know, we were literally sitting on top of the wicket, literally. It was just fantastic. And you could hear, you heard the shot of Tendulkar's bat for about a nanosecond, and then you heard the crowd. And it was just, it's an open, beautiful open stadium.
Yeah.
And utter madness, you know. Yeah, I don't know why we were sitting on that fantastic seat. It was really the best seat in the house. Even a camera, and next to us was a television camera. So obviously we had the best seats in the house. I never forgot that. It was that one, like literally that, we said, what?
You both painted some great pictures, four great pictures from iconic World Cup games, but I'm still not able to get over the fact that you could walk onto the pitch across the stadium to the dressing room, get coats and come back, which seems a whole different world, not just a few years apart. It seems like impossible today that you walk onto the pitch and go to the dressing room. It kind of feels like a county village game setting than a World Cup game. So that's something that is stunning detail, Sharda. Sharda, of course, spoke about press conferences in Pashto and the novelty of it all and how much fun it brings to the game. What's the most favorite or the one press conference memory that comes to your mind that you were part of? Because like Malinga, cricketers do give out great lines once in a while, but it's become rarer and rarer today, like we've already discussed. Fidel, in your time, what's the one thing that comes to your mind that, you know, that you were part of this presser and this great line came out and you just had to scramble to file it?
I know I'm going to be very disappointing on this because all press conferences have just like melded into one in my mind, and there's nothing that really stands out. I think there was one, but it wasn't from a World Cup. It was from a World T20 in Colombo in 2012 when India got knocked out of the tournament before the semis, and they had just recently lost 4-0 in the tests against England, and it was like probably the last real dip that Indian cricket had, and they were right in the middle of it, and obviously the Indian journalists weren't happy that they were critical of the team at the time. And I remember, you know, there were some people. Some journalists who kind of were yelling at Dhoni in the middle of the test conference, yelling things like, you know, when will this free fall end? You know, that kind of stuff. So that was memorable because I was a very young junior reporter then as well. And it was the first time I'd ever come across the intensity of Indian cricket, which is, you know, Sri Lanka cricket Sri Lanka cricket has lost more. There's been, you know, much bigger things happening in Sri Lanka cricket than just getting knocked out of a tournament, but it never has got anywhere near that intense. So that was an experience in itself, just because of the vastness of what India is and what cricket means. That was an interesting press conference, but not from a World Cup. But there you go.
Sharda, of course, has written Yuvraj Singh's co-authored his biography, a co-star in his biography. So I'm going to ask her to narrate one great story from Yuvraj Singh at the 2011 World Cup about how he almost preempted his stats from the tournament. Just halfway into the tournament, he came to a press conference and told a bunch of journalists he was going to make so many runs and take so many wickets, and lo and behold, at the end of the tournament, he was almost there, wasn't he, Sharda? That's before you narrate your favorite press conference.
No, that actually was, he didn't tell it, he wouldn't say it to a bunch of journalists. It was, he had gone to dinner. A friend of mine had gone with him for dinner, and he was sort of not feeling, and he was coughing, and you kept thinking there's something wrong with him. because he kept coughing. And that's when he told him. He said, and this is just after they had lost the match against South Africa. You know, it was their league phase was like, if he
the last lost over. South
Africa. Yeah, yeah, that one. They lost that one. Yeah, in which apparently Nehra had a hilarious encounter with someone in an airport that I tell you about later. They lost that match. And he said, and you know, everyone was in this big funk and all the rest of it, and it was in India, and you know, they couldn't walk, they couldn't get out of their, never mind get out of their rooms. Even the room service guy would be telling them, sir, please, now come on, win. So at that time he told him that I'm going to get 15 wickets and score X number of runs, 500, 600, whatever it was, you know. So he told a friend of his, and this guy came back and told me, you know, he's mad. Why is he saying this? You know, why is he even going in this direction? I remember he came, I was desperately trying to scramble memories from my mind, you know, of press conferences, which you usually forget because they are so same. But Yuvraj did a great one in Ahmedabad when he played that fantastic knock against Australia in the quarterfinal. And he walked in and he got, people were clapping for him. So because that's the Indian journey, the press corps largely, you know, you either want to throw tomatoes at the team or you stand up and clap for them. You know, There's nothing in the middle.
It's what Pinel said, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, it was just mad. And he walked in and he said, you know, this is the first time I've got standing ovation at a press. I've got an applause at a press conference. I must have done something good. He had great press conferences in that World Cup, because eventually only he would turn up because he was man of the match, or Dhoni would turn up, and we got tired of it by the end of it, you know. But after the final, when India won the final, and Yuvraj walked into the press conference, and he was just thrilled beyond, you could see it on his face, and he kept saying "Badhai ho, badhai ho," which is like congratulations, congratulations to the entire press lot that was there. You know, so it was a good moment. You get a bit jaded after you work for so long, but you forget what a World Cup victory means when until it happens again. You go out into the street the next day and you just see what the difference is made to everybody. You know, which is what had happened in 2011.
Two complete extremes of the Indian team, from Dhoni being yelled at to Yuvraj coming and yelling congratulations to Indian journalists. That's just how it rolls in the subcontinent. Fidel, I'm going to come to you about a recent event which I happen to be part of. I think you were on a packed train to Cardiff during this World Cup, and there was a half joking request for you to file from the train while you were standing and asked to narrate how things were with fans who were just chock-a-block on a train ride to Cardiff. Good time to ask you, what's the oddest story or video request you got from an editor while traveling at a World Cup? It doesn't matter whether or not it eventually happened.
Yeah, I think actually that could be the one, because I had literally just landed in the UK the night before at about 8 p.m. So I only got to my hotel about 10:30. And then I was writing a story about till about 3 a.m. And then I had to go catch a train at 6:30. So I'd had about 2 hours sleep. And there were two editors asking me, half jokingly, but to go and just like do vox pops of people on the train. And there's nothing that British commuters or British people on trains love more than being approached by random strangers and asked to speak into a microphone, obviously. And it was such a outlandish request that I just ignored them. So yeah, that probably stands out, not least because it's the most recent. I don't think I've been asked to do too many crazy things other than that. But yeah, that was definitely an interesting one.
I've got a great story which I must tell you, which happened in 2011. So we, you know, Cricket had just moved into this multimedia age and we were doing audio recording. And so at one point in a match in Nagpur, so we used to do a little short Q&A with Sanjay Manjrekar after the match was over. And suddenly then we became very fussy that, listen, if it's an audio recording, it has to be absolutely clear. You cannot have all background noise and all. And the only place in the stadium in Nagpur after that match in which India had lost, where Sanjay Manjrekar and I could record a conversation without anyone either walking past us or there being noise or there being doors opening, slamming, was in the ladies' toilet. And it was sort of, we weren't in the toilet, we were just in the sort of area where the basin is, you know, but you had to walk in and close the door. So Sanjay Manjrekar and me are doing question answer. Then of course the next match after that, when it reached the semi-final, it became that, okay, now you have to have Sanjay and Ramesh talking together about the match that's going to happen. Again, audio recording.
At the same venue? No,
this was Chandigarh, just before
Chandigarh. This is Mohali, right, sorry.
This is Mohali, we go to Mohali, and of course everyone is very into this, I don't know if you remember this, but it was a very big deal to do audio recordings. This is 2011, not so long ago. And I was carrying this very fancy recorder, which you have to take a PhD degree to operate it. Otherwise, it doesn't record. You have to do all kinds of things. So then we are in Sanjay Manjaka's room and Ramiz is there and we're all set to go. And now we need to have the recorder put at a particular height so that both of them who are sitting in these two chairs opposite them. There's no standing for some reason. I don't know why we weren't standing. So the two of them sat opposite each other. And then Sanjay said, no, this is not the right way to record it. So he went into the bathroom and he got a bucket, a plastic bucket out. He turned the bucket over on the coffee table. He put a towel on top of the bottom of the bucket and he put the recorder in it and did the recording. And it turned out crystal clear and fantastic. So you see this and you think of it now and, you know, of all the things to remember of the World Cup, but it was pretty funny. And they had a very emotional conversation and they talked about what it meant for Indians and Pakistanis.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
But I remember the bucket, it was green. And there was a white towel on top of it, and on top of it was the recorder doing its job.
Outstanding, outstanding recollection of colors and chromes and whatnot, Chara. That was great. Just before we wrap up, since you've been to so many of these, one last question, which is on the craziest bunch of fans you've met. I know you're doing Afghanistan from time to time at this World Cup, and how important is it for you to soak in the game atmosphere by stepping out of the press box, like Fidel said, the whole Wahab thing that he mentioned and spoke about how fans were utterly captivated by what was happening. What's the craziest bunch of fans that you've met traveling with the World Cup?
At 2003, it was the first time that Indian fans traveled outside, say England, for example, to come and watch matches. So you kept bumping into these fans for the first time, which now you see everywhere. But that was literally the first time that I met them. And, Indians, Pakistanis, they tend to be all a sort of same level of crazy when it comes to cricket. So I'm not trying to think of, specific degrees of thing. But what I really liked is what I did a couple of days ago in Cardiff. You don't get a chance to go out that much now and sit in the stand because you have to be chatting to people in live report as well in Cricket Info, as you see. So we have to be so you don't get a chance to go out that much. But there was a rain break in Cardiff and they had this the Papare band from Melbourne, Fidel and other those hardcore fans, they had turned up. And they, during the break, they went off to have a little bit of a drink and some food. And we were about to leave there. So myself and one of my other younger colleagues, we were there. And we were about to leave that place and go. And I said, no, wait, let them come back. Because they're going to replace the middle order. So, so they got back. And then they literally, it was a small clutch of people in a corner of the stand in Cardiff. But they were fantastic. Because then they started playing and everybody started dancing. And there were Afghans there and there were local Welsh people there pretending to be dressed as Afghans for some reason with their faces painted. And so it was a really nice kind of an atmosphere that you had that, you know, it told you that eventually, hey, this is a sport. We are having fun. There's music, there's dancing, there's going to be some cricket or maybe there won't. Who cares? You know, it was lovely. I enjoyed it. It'll be one of my memories that will stay from this World Cup about interacting with fans and so on.
Throughout this whole conversation, we've been on for about 40 minutes now. One thing I just realized is there's not been a single mention of the 2007 World Cup, for obvious reasons, I suppose, that it was too short for it to be remembered.
It was a disaster. It was a bizarre World Cup because I was dying. I've always been dying to go to the West Indies because I always wanted to see cricket there. And I went to Trinidad. And then, of course, India lost to Bangladesh. And as they try to forget every time. But it was a very short World Cup. And because I was working for India Today magazine, they said, India's out, you come back. So literally, I watched two games in which India played badly and lost, and or rather Bangladesh and Sri Lanka played very well and won. But it was a fun World Cup. You know, I didn't like going back in the middle of it, even though it was with the Indian team. But they were bizarre. It was the most bizarre event because you had an Australian TV channel that had got permission. Greg Chappell had either given them permission to come and shoot the team, including, you know, their huddles during training. So, like, can you imagine a camera, like, not even the broadcaster's camera. It's an independent camera park.
Are you saying there was a documentary shot on that car crash of a campaign?
There was a documentary shot. It was part of a documentary shot on what was the car crash that was Greg Chappell's coaching career in. So it was part of that. And so there was that going on. Then that horrible story of Bob Woolmer, who died suddenly in the middle of it. So it just seemed like it was a hexed World Cup almost.
Quite tragic, yeah.
So and it all happened at the same time. And of course, my office, India Today, at the time, they called me and said, listen, we need the scoop on Bob Woolmer. I said, I am in Trinidad. That happened in Jamaica. It is a considerable distance away. Are you sending me a helicopter? You know, and I didn't exactly say that. I would have been fired if I had. But yeah, so it was quite an awful World Cup in some ways, you know. But in terms of stories and everything that was there, I mean, those TV camera guys were just gold, you know. That were there.
Yeah, I'll just jump in here and say my memories of that World Cup were so different. I mean, all I remember is Malinga's 4-4. Mahela's 100 in the semi-final, Sri Lanka almost going all the way. So I sympathize with the Pakistan and India fans and reporters, but that was a wonderful World Cup for Sri Lanka, because from having a pretty average team, suddenly they were winning matches and they just caught fire. So for some of us, and also I was living in New Zealand at the time, and the time zone kind of worked. So it was great. I love that World Cup. Maybe the only person to do so.
Such contrasting stories and emotions from two reporters who've been part of the World Cup. And Fidel was, of course, a fan back then, watching the World Cup and following the World Cup from New Zealand. That's all about all we have time for in this episode of Talking World Cup. Thanks, Fidel. Thanks, Sharada. Thanks for your time in the middle of the World Cup.
Thanks. I totally enjoyed this.
Lovely. So did I. Thanks, Fidel. And thanks to you, listener. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. This episode, of course, is dedicated to all the Sri Lankan fans who take transcontinental voyages to come and watch their team, the Papare band, which Sharada mentioned, and everyone else who's coming to make the World Cup the special spectacle that it is. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a review, because that helps more people find the podcast. And of course, you can listen to it anywhere else, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, Audio Boom, or wherever else you get your podcast from. That's it from all of us at ESPN Cricket Info for now. Do join us and look forward to your company next time. Cheers.